From KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So there's a really critical question in Jonathan Haidt's book, The Righteous Mind. Just where does morality come from? You know, are we born with some sense of morality, or do we come to the world a blank slate? Well, Haidt says it's a little bit of both. But we definitely evolved these impulses, and not just to protect ourselves. He says we were born with other intuitions, like a desire for liberty and loyalty and sanctity. Today in the program, Jonathan Haidt will join us to take us on a tour of human nature and history from his vantage point as a scholar who studies moral psychology. He's hoping to give us all a new way of thinking about the things that divide us, like religion and politics. It's the psychology of this struggle between for and against. The Righteous Mind, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's a little more complicated than how I'm going to put it, but Jonathan Haidt says we're born with a sense of morality. And if you think about the evolutionary advantages of getting along in large groups, it makes sense morality made us more safe or secure. But those aren't the only impulses embedded in our brains. Haidt says we were also born with a sense of loyalty and authority and sanctity. But none of that means we're inherently good, just complicated. In his book, he says human nature may be intrinsically moral, but it's also intrinsically moralistic and intrinsically critical and intrinsically judgmental. What he's trying to do is give us another way of understanding why we don't get along. And in some ways, this can help you better understand why a conservative thinks like a conservative and a liberal thinks like a liberal. Today in the program, Jonathan Haidt is joining us to talk about his book. It's called The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. Jonathan Haidt is a social psychologist and a professor of business ethics at NYU Stern School of Business. He's also the author of The Happiness Hypothesis, and he's joining us today from Argo Studios in New York City. And Jonathan Haidt, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Doug. Thanks for having me back on the program.
So I wanted to start at the beginning of the book. You invoke this what's come to be kind of this pedestrian plea from Rodney King, you know, years ago. He said, "Can we all get along?" Which you admit has become a little overused as a kind of thought of as a sort of trite catchphrase now. But you found something kind of profound in that appeal, not the part that's quoted, but the part that comes a little bit later. And I wanted to talk about that, explain why you started with this Rodney King bit.
Sure. I originally had a different introduction to the book. You know, when you write a big, long book, you do the introduction last, and I kind of dashed something off, and my editor didn't like it. And, you know, the time was running out. I had to think of something quickly, and I thought of using the Rodney King intro, but I thought, oh, God, that's so hackneyed. Everybody says, you know, can't we all get along? Can't we all get along? But I decided to look into it, and I looked at the full text of that moment in the interview. It was actually quite moving. He you know, you can see the video of it, and you can see how emotional he is, how upset he was by the riots. And he says, he doesn't actually say what people think. He doesn't say, can't we all get along? He says, people, we can get along. Can we all get along? And then he goes on and he says, I should find the exact quote here. Basically, he says, we're all stuck here for a while.
Yeah.
So let's try to work it out.
Right.
And that's something I hadn't heard before. But, you know, that's what it feels like these days. Like, you know, we're all stuck together in this country. We love this country. But it's like it's going to hell. We can't work together to stop it.
Mm. And that's – so what got you thinking about this first? I mean, this struck you as, yeah, this is kind of what I'm doing, is trying to say, look, we're stuck here. Let's figure this out. What got you started thinking about all of this?
Well, I began in graduate school studying morality. That was my topic. I went to the University of Pennsylvania for a PhD in psychology, and I was studying morality. And back then, it meant moral development. And I was studying that, and I thought it was a little bit dull, the readings I was doing. And then I took a course in cultural psychology, and it was like falling in love. It was just so amazing to see how morality varies around the world. But at the same time, all these really obscure and arcane things, you can still find them. Like when you look at fraternity initiations, for example, you see a lot of the same morality and, you know, the loyalty, the authority, as you find in traditional tribal societies. So that suggested to me there's something in our brains, there's some part of human nature that can come out in the weirdest places, or it can be suppressed. And that was the puzzle that I really set out to figure out. What's in our heads and how does it develop?
Is it because you figured it didn't make, at least initially it didn't make sense because it wasn't just about the survival of the fittest? Like, it didn't make sense. You know, why would loyalty or why would sanctity, that's even more complicated or more abstract, that doesn't seem to make sense initially. And that's the thing that was intriguing
about
it. Go ahead.
Yeah, the emotion of disgust makes sense. So the way I started was by saying, let's stop looking at moral reasoning. That's what everybody was studying back then in the 1980s.
Yeah.
Let's look at the emotions, because the emotions have to make sense. The emotions are basically little survival programs that make us prepared to deal with recurrent situations. So anger, you know, somebody transgresses on our rights or takes our stuff, we're ready to rip their heads off, and that makes people not want to do it again. Mm. Disgust. We live in a world full of bacteria, parasites, so we're really sensitive to what things have touched. We don't want to eat something if we just saw it touch something dirty or gross. So the emotions have to make sense.
Yeah.
And what I was interested in is the way that different cultures build their moralities around different sets of emotions. Mm. So in a society that does trade and commerce, well, there's a lot of talk about fairness, but not a lot of concern about group loyalty or respect for authority. But in one that does herding or agriculture, well, then you get a lot more sense of personal responsibility to the group, loyalty to the group, respect for hierarchy. So those are the kinds of puzzles that got me in. This has nothing to do with politics. This was just what I was studying in grad school and afterwards.
You chose the word righteous. Why that word? Because there's this linkage between the word and this idea of judgment.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So the interesting puzzle for me is how we as a species came to be so concerned about what everybody else is doing. you know, we're very similar to chimpanzees in a lot of our social lives. You know, the way we play, even our sexuality has something in common, all sorts of similarities. But we live so much of our lives talking about and thinking about bad things done by others to others. And sometimes these people don't even exist. I mean, we love TV and soap operas. We make up this stuff just so we can talk about it. Chimps don't. No other animal does. So our great breakthrough, I think, was that we developed a way of weaving these webs of significance, these webs of meaning. Mm. And then we live in these webs. And this is the moral matrix. And I mean that like the matrix in the movie The Matrix. Yeah. We all live in a consensual hallucination. So that's why I called it the righteous mind, because we make up all this stuff. We judge each other constantly. It makes for all kinds of ugly interactions, hypocritical interactions. But at the same time, if we didn't do this, there'd be no civilization out there at all. We'd be just like chimpanzees living in small groups in the woods.
Well, this is what is so interesting, because you talk about how all of this means we're guaranteed, these groups, to be cursed by this moralistic strife. And you say you believe that a world without moralism, you know, without gossip and judgment, as you've put it, would decay quickly, pretty quickly into chaos, that this is good.
Right.
This is a good thing.
Well, you know, this is the lot of human beings. We can't have paradise on Earth. We can definitely make things better, but we can't possibly have a unified world with one government in which everyone gets along. We would just pretty quickly split into there's always something to fight over. We're not good at thinking globally. Mm. The only way we're ever going to really think globally is on the mythical day when the Martians or the Alpha Centaurians come and we all have to unite like in that terrible movie Independence Day, that schlocky movie from about 8 or 10 years
right.
ago. Short of that, I mean, you know, look, you fight with your friends, you fight with your lovers. I mean, we're a moralistic species. We're looking out for ourselves and for our groups, and we're just not good at thinking about the human group.
So I guess the idea is then to find that balance, find some kind of equilibrium, knowing that there will always be the strife, there will be moments of good, but just realizing that we tend to live in that tension, I guess.
Yes, but I think we can do more than just say, well, gosh, we got to balance it out. I think if we take a cold, hard look at who we are, at what we're really like, we can then design systems that work a lot better with our evolved nature.
Yeah.
And so the metaphor that I use in the book is that we are all really the descendants of Glaucon. Now, Glaucon was this interesting character in Plato's Republic who poses a question to Socrates. Socrates is trying to show that to know the good is to do the good, and if a man studies philosophy and he will live by what is right. And Glaucon says, well, Socrates, what about if a man had the ring of Gyges? This was a mythical ring where if you turn the stone in towards your hand, you become invisible. And Glaucon says, what man, if he had this, would stay on the straight and true? What man would not go into his neighbor's homes and take what he wanted of their fortunes and their women? He says, Socrates, I won't be happy until you prove to me that a man who had the ring of Gyges, if he knew the truth, if he knew what was right, would do what was right. Socrates then spends a couple thousand pages, trying to prove him wrong. I don't think he succeeds. I think Glaucon was exactly right. And we see this all over the place. You know, when politicians or public servants or anybody has anonymity, they take from the till. They sell influence. I mean, you have terrible behavior. But if you have good monitoring, and especially Glaucon's great insight was what we really care most about was our reputations. So if we can design systems where everybody's reputation is on the line all the time, then people actually behave pretty well. You don't really have to balance. You can actually get up to our best behavior.
So this is where you sort of say the take-home message for the book is this ancient idea that on the one hand we're self-righteous hypocrites, but enlightenment can help us understand how all of this works. And as you said, create – because it sounds like you're wanting something quite practical out of all of this. Mm-hmm. Take this knowledge and use it to understand how we all think, why we think this way, and design these systems or ways of understanding each other so we can get along better in real terms.
Exactly. That's right. Exactly. So if you look at the U.S. Congress, you know, an incredibly dysfunctional institution, the founding fathers were very wise in many ways, but unfortunately, there isn't really any oversight over Congress. And so they've engineered for themselves situations in which they have such massive conflicts of interest that given that they're human beings, they're not worse than you and me, but they're human beings put in situations with unbelievable conflicts of interest where if they try to behave ethically, fully ethically, they will lose so quickly because they need to take money for their elections. They need to take money to support their families. They need to make all kinds of deals. They're revolving doors for their staff. I mean, Washington is shot through with conflicts of interest. Mm. And if we could hire Glaucon to go in there and say, okay, we're going to rearrange things so that everybody's going to know every dollar you take from everybody. We're going to rearrange things so that no staff member can take a job in one of these companies that they're supposed to be regulating for 5 or 10 years. I mean, these staff members, they can get huge, huge contracts. They can get huge salaries as soon as they quit, as long as they're nice to the gas company that they're regulating. Mm. So, I mean, Washington is incredibly corrupt and dysfunctional, and we expect people to just do what's right. Well, that's not practical. I would much rather engineer the environment so that selfish, normal, ordinary people will end up doing what's right out of their own self-interest and reputational interest. Mm.
You break the book into these different principles. There are three of them in all. And the first one is this. Intuitions come first. Strategic reasoning comes second. So let's break that down because what you're saying is we have to think about morality not just as this thing that we have reasoned out, but something that we're born with in some ways, that we come to the world with this skill, this impulse.
That's right. Well, I would break it down this way. Let's start with the developmental question. Where does it come from?
Yeah.
The analogy that I've found most helpful is to think of our moral mind as being like a tongue with 6 taste buds.
Right.
And I guess that's the second principle. We'll get there.
Yeah,
we'll get there in a moment. Okay, so let's go back. Right, so
yeah.
Let's go to that. So intuitions come first. The last time I was on your show about 5 years ago to talk about my first book, The Happiness Hypothesis, you and I talked about the metaphor in that book, which is the mind is divided into parts like a rider on an elephant.
Right.
The rider is that little bit of our minds that can think and reason and uses words and can do math and can do logic. And the elephant is the other 99% of our minds, which is all the automatic stuff, which includes emotion.
Yeah.
Now, what I found in my early research is that when I would give people moral problems or puzzles to solve, they would usually know the right answer within 1 second. They would usually have an instant judgment, a gut reaction, and then they would try to make up reasons to justify it. So one of the stories I used was about a brother and sister who were on vacation from college in France. They decided it would be interesting and fun if they tried having sex. They use 2 forms of birth control. They enjoy it, but they keep that night as a special secret. Mm. What do you think about this? Is it okay for them to do it? And almost everybody that I interview says no. And then I say, well, why not? And they say, well, you know, I mean, incest causes birth defects. And I say, well, you know, that's true. I mean, if they were to have kids, of course it would be wrong because it could create a damaged baby. But suppose you were certain that there could be no child to come of it. Then would it be okay? And nobody ever said, oh, yeah, well, then it would be okay. Instead, they say, oh, yeah, you're right. Let's see. Okay, why else? Let me see. And they'd say, well, how old are they? And I say, they're 19 or 20. Oh, shoot. Okay. Because they were, you know, the person was hoping maybe they were underage. He could have another reason to justify it. My point is that our moral judgments are a lot like our aesthetic judgments. If you look at a painting or if you look at a beautiful woman or man, you don't sit around and reason, is she attractive? Is he attractive? You know instantly. And then, you know, you can talk about it. But the reasoning comes second. And the reasoning is really the reasoning of a lawyer who's looking for justifications to reach the conclusion that he is told to reach.
It's interesting because it's – so on one hand, you know, the sort of basic answers to the question, you've got on one hand the idea that you're born with it, that it's native to our minds. It comes, as you put it in the book, we come preloaded. Or nurture, which is John Locke's view, that children come as these blank slates at birth. You say that's a false choice. You say there's a third way, the rationalist answer.
Well, there are three. That's right. There are three choices that psychologists have looked at. One is to say it's all innate. Another is to say that it's all learned. And a third is to say that we sort of figure it out ourselves in the course of interacting with other kids. We reason our way through things. I think that all three are wrong if you take them in the extreme form. But
right.
If you lighten up on the nativism one, if you lighten up on the innate one, that's the correct one actually. So the key thing is to realize that innate does not mean hardwired. It doesn't mean that on the day a kid is born, he understands group loyalty and respect for authority. Rather, what innate means is structured in advance of experience. But experience then revises that structure. So if you look at, say, sexual orientation, a baby isn't attracted to anyone sexually. But on the day a child is born, there's a little node in the hypothalamus called the preoptic node, which has one of two settings. Either it's going to be attracted to male bodies or female bodies. And it's affected by prenatal testosterone. That's what gives it – that's what switches it over from the female pattern to the male pattern in boys. And so sexual orientation is to a large extent innate. It's not something that you learn. But the particular standards of beauty will vary, and you learn those. How to express your sexuality, you learn. Mm. So you've got to start by saying almost everything important about us, especially if it has anything to do with survival, like food, sex, morality, these things come pre-structured. And that's what part of my book is about. Mm. But then we grow up in different cultures, and we end up, you know, I mean, American morality is very, very different from Chinese, Japanese, Indian morality. So you've got to look at how we have this universal human nature that grows up in variable ways.
You talk about – this sort of gets at this idea where you're writing about how reason and moral intuition works together with each other. You write about how, for example, Plato believed reason to be the master of those two. Jefferson figured, look, they're both sort of equal. Hume says passion – is the master of reason, and that's sort of where you come down. But I want to get a sense. You say that we need to be using then a sort of more intuitionist approach. But explain what you mean by that, because you say we need to be more humble about our abilities. We need to be more attuned to these systems. How do we let passion be the guide? What is that? How does that sort of manifest itself, if that makes sense?
Right. So in each individual – passion is the master. Passion tends to drive reasoning. Now, there are some people, philosophers, mathematicians, there are some people who are relatively low on emotion, relatively high on reasoning. And when they're able to reason about the things they're working on professionally, I don't doubt that reason drives things. But when you get them in discussions about morality and politics, you know, they're usually partisan. They're on one side or the other. And then they're like normal human beings. They're committed to one side or the other, and then they use their very high IQ to find arguments on that side.
Right.
So now Plato was very aware that people often do this. He just held out the hope that if people would learn enough philosophy, they'd stop doing it, and then they could be philosopher kings who could resist temptation. Well, you know, maybe there's a person born every 100 years that can do that, but there are not many, certainly not enough to staff a government with. So I'm not saying let passion run the government. Yeah. I'm saying acknowledge that each of us is biased by our gut feelings, our intuitions, our selfishness, our ethnic group, our political party. We're all really biased by those things. And then set up systems so that those biases can cancel each other out. For example, juries are pretty smart institutions. I'm told by lawyers who study this, by legal theorists who study this, that juries actually work pretty well because each person has his own gut feeling and he looks for evidence to support it, and he's incapable of finding evidence against his gut feeling. That's called the confirmation bias. We all use our reasoning to find evidence to support what we want to believe.
Right.
So if you had a jury of one, that would be very bad news. But if you put 12 people together and they start with some different intuitions about the case, then the people on one side will challenge the people on the other and say, oh, but you forgot about this or what about that? Well, we can respond to reasons when they're given to us by other people if we trust them, if we like them, if we feel a sense of common purpose with them. You know, we're all here in this room. We got to figure this case out. We're not getting out until we do. So I'm told that juries work pretty well. Scientific communities, if they're balanced out, we each challenge each other's reasoning and evidence, that works great. But if everybody in the room is liberal or everybody in the room is conservative, then it fails. Then there's nobody on the other side to say, hey, what about this thing that you neglected?
Jonathan Haidt is with us. His book is The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. We're going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the psychologist Jonathan Haidt is with us to talk about why good people can't seem to get along. Just look at the intensity of our political differences these days. Haidt has looked at the latest research in neuroscience and genetics and psychology to explain all of this. Really, in some ways, it comes down to morality. He studies moral psychology. His book is called The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. So this moves us, Jonathan Haidt, to the part two of the book. And there's kind of a story. I don't know if you call it an epiphany, but you write about growing up Jewish in the suburbs of New York City. Your grandparents fled Tsarist Russia. So for them, you know, labor unions and socialism, these were kind of practical considerations. And you talk about how your own morality was sort of shaped by your, you know, college experience, by your family, all those kinds of things. And you said at the time, liberalism seemed pretty obviously ethical. But then you went to India, and you say when you returned, you started thinking about things differently. Talk about that if you would.
Mm-hmm, sure. So the metaphor for the the third part is morality binds and blinds. We'll get to that in a moment. But I grew up in a moral matrix that was entirely liberal. Jewish, New York, went to Yale, undergraduate, went into the academic world. Everybody was liberal. I never really met any conservatives. And this was the 1980s, the time of Ronald Reagan, when most intellectuals thought he was both stupid and evil. And they would sometimes say so in classes, and that was just in the air. So it just seemed, you know, the world looked black and white to me, as it mm-hmm. does to most young people. And then I go to graduate school. Just after graduate school, I get a fellowship to go to India. Now it's 1993. Clinton has just won the presidency, and the culture war is really heating up, and the religious right is really active,
yeah.
and Jerry Falwell and all those folks. And so I go over there, and I hate religious conservatives. But I go over to India, and I'm trying to be an open-minded anthropologist. I was working with a brilliant cultural psychologist, Richard Schwader, mm-hmm. at University of Chicago, was my advisor. And I was trying to be like him. I was trying to be open-minded and tolerant and understand these people who were religious, socially conservative, hierarchical. They lived in a sex-segregated world. And I was trying to see, well, you know, what was good about this? What did they think they were doing? Or, you know, what are the virtues that they actually cultivate that we don't? And after 3 months there, I did my best, and I could really kind of see some beauty. And I wouldn't want to live that way myself, but it wasn't – there were some virtues there. And then I come back to America and I listen again to the religious right. And suddenly I see, oh, my God, it's the same thing. Or at least there's a lot of the same thing, the importance of family, the importance of suppressing selfishness and getting people to play their role because we're all interdependent in the family, things like that. And suddenly it was like the scales fell from my eyes. It was like, oh, now that I've stepped out of the American liberal cultural matrix, the moral matrix, now I can actually see the conservatives without hatred and I can actually begin studying them for the first time in my life. So, you know, people often say that about foreign travel. You learn more about your own country than you do about the country you go to.
So you describe this as letting go of your anger, of your partisan anger.
Well, that's right. Here I was, a social scientist, trying to understand morality. Now, at the time, I was really just interested in how morality varies across nations. I wasn't focused on politics. But that was the beginning of my realization that a lot of the differences we study across nations work just as well in this country across the partisan divide. Unfortunately, we really have become like two different nations, two different cultures, not just with its own set of values and entertainment habits, and we watch different TV shows, but we have different facts. Mm. We have a different version of American history. We have different scientific beliefs. We're really becoming like two separate nations. And in that sense, cultural psychology is just what we need to understand across the divide.
Mm. So here's the central metaphor for this part of the book, that the righteous mind is like a tongue with six taste receptors. You write about morality being like taste. Talk about this. I identify this for us because I wanted to sort of break these down as you've identified
sure.
them.
So in the field of moral psychology, there was a lot of research on fairness. Now, who could deny that fairness is important to morality? And there was a lot of research on compassion, empathy, how kids learn to care for others that are suffering and how, you know, caring for animals. And there was even a debate as to whether compassion was the foundation of morality or fairness was the foundation of morality. It's one or the other.
Hmm.
And this matches up with the two great philosophical traditions of ethics, which is utilitarianism, where you try to minimize harm, and deontology, where you try to have rules that will protect people's rights and create a fair society. So that's the state of the debate when I got into moral psychology. There's really just these two issues, these two foundations. We call it care and fairness.
Yeah.
And when I went to India and I was studying with Rick Schwader, he was writing about how, well, actually, that's just one kind of morality, this sort of, you know, care and fairness, protect the individual morality. Other cultures have a morality that he called the ethics of community, where you try to make people conform to their roles, do their duty, respect authority and tradition, create social order. And others try to create a sacred space in which our basic divinity is respected. God is thought to be inherent in human beings. Our bodies are on loan. It sounds a little far out to secular liberals in the U.S., but you know, if you go back 100 years in the U.S., people were always talking about personal purity and physical purity, and masturbation was going to corrupt your soul.
Right.
So these are three different languages of morality. And when I turned my attention to studying politics later on, and I really tried to get into this and say, well, okay, what exactly are all the different cultures and different political groups? What exactly are they basing their moral arguments on? My conclusion, drawing from Schwader and others, was that in addition to care and fairness, there's a bunch of other stuff. There's group loyalty. Mm-hmm. There's respect for authority. There's a concern about liberty and not being oppressed. And there's a sense of sanctity or purity. And the metaphor is if you're a secular liberal, you tend to focus on those first two. It's like either sugar or salt. You know, on our actual tongues, we've got five different kinds of taste receptors. We've got sweet, salt, sour, bitter, and umami or MSG actually.
Yeah.
So we've got five different taste receptors on our tongue. But imagine if people were serving you, you know, in a restaurant. You went to a restaurant and the only flavors were sweet and salt. That's it. That would be kind of thin. And a lot of people don't want that. A lot of people long for a morality that binds groups together with loyalty and respect for authority and sanctity. So that's the theory that I and my colleagues came up with about how there are these six different taste receptors. And you can think of each morality as being like a cuisine or a meal that is based on a range of flavors.
But you write about how liberals, Democrats – at some point, and it seems like right around 1980 or thereabouts, they started neglecting some of those elements. And because you talk about how liberals mm-hmm. tend to focus on two or three of these receptors, whereas conservatives are pretty good at touching on all of them, which has made them, you say, better at
winning elections.
Winning elections, yeah, exactly. Talk about that, because it's mm-hmm. interesting why the Democratic Party had so much difficulty connecting mm-hmm. with voters.
Right. Yeah. So the turning point is the 1960s. So, you know, liberalism has a long and glorious history. Liberalism gave us the modern world. It's a revolt against king and clergy in the 18th century, standing up for truth and science. So liberalism has a long and glorious history. In the progressive era, now it's not king and clergy who are the threat. It's corporations and business interests. So the left turns to government to fight off the business interests. We go through the Roosevelt era. We get to the 1960s. So it still is about fighting the powerful, fighting for the little guy. But in the 60s, things change. And it's no longer about focusing on the poor. It becomes about focusing on certain groups that really were victimized, preeminently African Americans. Mm. So the civil rights struggle, the feminist struggle, these are two of the great victories, the great moral victories of modern times. But they transform the left. The left is no longer about fighting for the little guy. It now becomes fighting especially for African Americans and then by extension women and then gay people and handicapped people and other groups. So the right parodies these as a collection of victim groups, and there's some truth to it. Where I think the left pays for this, and they paid dearly for it, is once they forgot about the little guy in general, think about the white working class. Once they became the party fighting for four or five specific groups, well, people who weren't in those groups had no interest in staying in the coalition. Ronald Reagan picked off the so-called Reagan Democrats. Mm-hmm. And it's not just racism. It's not just, oh, you know, we don't like black people, so we're going to vote Republican. It's, all right, so the left is using government to have all these programs to advance African Americans and women. But, you know, I'm a white working class guy. I can't get a job. They're giving all the jobs to others. There's been an emphasis on these groups. So, you know, I work at a university. We've got this thing called Title IX pushed by Democrats. Title IX guarantees equality in sports. Well, fine. Equality of access would be great. Of course, women who want to play sports should be able to play. But what happens is everyone insists on applying it for equality of outcomes. And women are – there's just not as many women interested in playing sports. So the crew team at every university that I've been at, the crew team is kicked off. They say, oh, you go raise money for yourselves. We can't support you because that would be too many men. Whereas every possible female team is fielded and the women are recruited. The university is desperate to get women. So there's massive inequality in the service of equality of outcome. Hmm. These are some really unethical applications, I think. The right – loves to parody them. The right loves to show how unfair the left is. So in other words, I think the left kind of got off track in the 60s with the new left and the devotion to groups that were victimized.
You say that social conservatives have the broadest understanding of morality. I think you were referencing this earlier. They see the importance of, you know, constraining impulses, the idea of constraint, the right to stress merit and earned rewards, not forcing equality. I'm wondering how much has this then changed your own ideology?
It has changed my ideology somewhat. So one thing that people really have to understand is that both sides are diverse. There are a variety of views on the left and the right. On the right, there are three main subtypes that need to be distinguished. There are the free market conservatives, the business types who want deregulation, free trade. These people are not conservative in any psychological or historical sense. They love the free market, and that actually is traditionally a liberal idea.
Right.
So don't consider those conservative. Then among conservatives, then there are the authoritarians. There are people who are really concerned about diversity and immigrants and people who disrupt the social order. And those people are the ones who actually get the most racist and have racist responses and want to stamp out deviants. Those are the ones who give conservatives a bad name. And then there are what you'd call the true conservatives or the Burkean conservatives after Edmund Burke, the Irish philosopher, 18th century Irish philosopher. And these are the ones who I think have some really good sociological insights that if you remove all the constraints, you don't get a flowering of liberty and wonderfulness. If you remove all the constraints, you actually get kind of chaos and people taking advantage of each other and people not working that hard and society falls apart. You need some order and some structure. It's actually good to have some shared reverence, to worship together the founding fathers or the flag or things like that. And, you know, as a social scientist, I just came to conclude that Burke was right. And later on, the sociologist Emil Durkheim came to very similar views. So this has changed my views. I have the personality of a liberal. I'm high on openness to experience. I enjoy diversity and foreign travel. I live in New York City. I've got the personality of a liberal. But I think that a lot of conservative insights are incredibly valuable for running a good society. Now, I'm not saying the Republican Party. The Republican Party is going off the deep end in its moralistic spiral surrounding cutting taxes, cutting government, things like that. They're going through the same kind of moral craziness that I think the Democrats went through in the 70s when they were circling around victim groups. So I'm not saying anything in favor of the Republican Party, but I have come to respect traditional conservative ideas quite a lot.
Are you seeing any shifting in that? I'm thinking of the Democratic National Convention, for example. I'm wondering if you heard rhetoric that was starting to sort of shift a little bit.
Yes, definitely. So Bill Clinton pulled the party back in the 90s, back towards the center, and addressed some of the most egregious. I mean, the welfare, you know, the welfare policies implemented in the 60s were horrific. They destroyed families. They encouraged non-work. They encouraged non-marital childbearing. And Clinton came in with a really good slogan. You know, basically, he was talking about personal responsibility and you know, people who play by the rules. And so that's a real hit. I mean, you know, that's something that conservatives care more about than liberals, but everybody endorses. So Clinton pulled the party back towards the center. But then in the 2000 election and the Netroots in 2004, there was a kind of a rejection of Clintonism, and the party moved more to the left. Now, I think Obama is at heart a centrist. I think he's a really an incredibly smart, analytical systems thinker who's moderate in his inclinations. And I think he's been very receptive. He's able to speak to conservatives, at least in his biography, in the 2008 campaign. He was able to acknowledge a lot of conservative values and concerns. They kind of went away, I think, after he was elected. But in this election, what I've seen is that Obama never talks about equality. He doesn't talk about equality of outcome. He doesn't harp on, like, you know, with Occupy Wall Street, it's very, very concerned about massive income inequality.
Yeah.
Obama, I think, he's been reading the psychology on this, that the key is to talk about proportionality. That is, you want to make what his mantra is something like an America where everyone gets a fair shot and everyone does their fair share and everyone plays by the same rules. So those are three arguments about fairness, none of which are about equality of outcome. Now, a lot of people on the left care a lot about equality of outcome, but I think he knows that that's a loser in American political space. Hmm. You've got to talk about proportionality. That is, people who work hard should get ahead and people who don't shouldn't.
It's interesting. Maybe this is a diversion, but it did make me wonder what you think about the debate over marriage equality, for example. I mean, progressives seem to be arguing, you know, that marriage and the family is an important institution and that all people should have access to that institution.
Yep. No, I fully agree. And where were they for the last 30 or 40 years? In other words, marriage was very suspect on the left in the 60s and 70s as part of the feminist revolution. And marriage rates began to drop. Out-of-wedlock birth rates began to skyrocket in the 60s and 70s. And the left was silent because I don't know if it was out of concern for women or because African-Americans were the main ones then where marriage was declining or whether it was out of concern for gay people. But the left was silent on the value of the family for decades. And the social science evidence is really clear. Marriage is incredibly important for children. The decline of marriage in the bottom two-thirds of the population is one of the biggest drivers of our massive and growing inequality. So I fully agree. Marriage is incredibly important. We need to encourage it everywhere. I think it's incredibly important to have marriage equality. Now, personally, as for whether states want to call it a civil union or marriage, I think that needs to be a state decision. I think we have a federalist system. As long as basic rights are guaranteed to all, I think it should be up to the states whether to call it marriage. Unfortunately, we've had a backlash, and some states are now even banning civil unions, which I think is terrible. So I do think marriage is really important. The right has been screaming about it for decades. The left is finally catching up and saying, yeah, we need to encourage this.
So the left is saying this is a family value. And you're seeing then a response, as you say, from the right, this sort of moralistic fervor that could backfire. It seems like it could, I don't know if it could reverse itself, but that's certainly an interesting dynamic.
It is an interesting dynamic. That's true. You see, what you see a lot of, so George Lakoff wrote a really wonderful book in the late 1990s called Moral Politics. Yeah. And he wrote a book in 2004, Don't Think of an Elephant. And this has been a Bible on the left. It's very good psychology. Everybody learned about framing, how important it is to frame things. But what I see is the Democrats taking this too seriously. The Democrats, I think, have tried to frame all their policies and arguments as though they can just find the right words and they can put this new frame out there into message space. It'll somehow get into people's ears and it'll turn a lock and key and it'll persuade people. But I think persuasion doesn't really work that way. We don't just get persuaded because we're walking down the street and we hear a message and we suddenly say, oh, I never thought of it that way. I'll change my mind. Mm. We have to really trust the messenger. And
so it's more than just language.
That's right. That's right. Because, again, intuitions come first and then reasoning comes later. So if the Democrats are seen as the party that's really trying to shore up marriage and social stability and give kids a stable environment, you know, then they'd be more credible on it. But we have this very unfortunate dynamic happening in the country where married people are now mostly Republicans and single people are Democrats. People with children are mostly Republicans and people without children are mostly Democrats. Urban people are Democrats. I mean, we're splitting in all these different ways. Mm. And, you know, if most people who are married, parents, religious, and have a job, if most of those people are Republicans, that's going to – you know, and that's true on each of those divisions. It does split Republican-Democrat that way. It just means that the Democrats are – you know, they seem less credible when they argue about certain policies.
Jonathan Haidt is with us. His book is The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. And we need to take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Jonathan Haidt. We're talking about his book, The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. Brings us to part three of the book, Jonathan Haidt. The third principle, morality binds and blinds. And the central metaphor here is human beings are 90% chimp, 10% bee. Talk about this third principle.
Sure. So many of your listeners will have either read Richard Dawkins or have been exposed to evolutionary thinking and selfish genes. And and I think that's a very powerful perspective. And I think it's basically right. You have to look at our evolution in terms of we have traits that helped our ancestors survive. And we are primates. We're very similar, as I said, to chimpanzees. But something happens around a half million years ago. Humans began veering off on a path very, very different from any other animal on the planet. It's a little bit analogous to the path taken by bees and ants. Mm. That is, you have these other animals that can cooperate in massive, huge groups, but they do it because they have a queen and then they're all sterile, so they're all sisters and they can only reproduce through the queen. So nature has found ways to create very cooperative creatures for bees, ants, and termites and wasps and things like that. Chimpanzees are not cooperative. They can work together a little bit when they're hunting. Scientists debate whether they're truly cooperating or just kind of all working in parallel. But other than hunting, they don't really do much together. And when I heard a primatologist say, it is inconceivable that you would ever see two chimpanzees carrying a log together, I thought, oh my God, they really are different from us. I mean, they're so smart as individuals, but they can't really work together. Yet we humans do it effortlessly. I mean, you walk, you know, from the time you leave your house in the morning until the time you get to work, you've cooperated with 500 people probably. So how did we get so cooperative? Mm. The path that I take in the book is to trace out how we are products of individual level selection. That is, we have traits that help us beat out our neighbor or be more fit than our neighbor. But we also have a whole bunch of traits that help us be good team members, good group members that help our group beat out other groups. So I think we evolved by a process called multi-level selection. That is, evolution occurs at multiple levels simultaneously. So there's competition among individuals, and at the same time, there's competition among groups. I think it's self-evident that that's true, that that's the way our lives are. And that's nowhere more clear than in politics. We've got factions within factions within factions. We're just really good at forming groups to compete with other groups, and we can shift those around. So the metaphor is that, yeah, it's true that we're, you know, we're like chimps in most ways. We're selfish. We're just as Glaucon said. But sometimes we go through a kind of a phase change. We can become part of a group. We can go through initiation rites into a fraternity. We can play in a band or be on a sports team where we really don't care about whether, you know, I score the goal or not. We just want the team to win. And this is the element of groupishness that I think has been underappreciated in many of the social sciences in recent decades that I'm trying to bring back in my book. So if you understand that morality binds and blinds, that our moral nature doesn't just help us deal with each other as individuals, it helps us be good group members to compete with other groups, well, then I think you can get a lot of new insights into religion, politics, all sorts of the groupish things that we do.
Say something more about religion, if you would, because you write in the book, religion is probably one of those evolutionary adaptations for binding groups together and helping them create these communities.
That's right. This has been the biggest debate in recent research on religion. Many of your listeners will have heard of Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, or Sam Harris has a number of books, The End of Faith, things like that. Now, in part, these are arguing that God doesn't exist. And, you know, I'm an atheist. I don't think that God exists either. I don't know. Nobody can be certain. But let's leave that whole question aside. Yeah. What these books also argue is that religions are not just delusions. They're pernicious delusions. They're sets of memes or ideas that somehow got together in idea space and took over our brains and made us do stupid things like suicide bombing, which is bad for the individual, but boy, it's really good for Islam. That's the sort of thing that the new atheists argue. I think while it's a coherent view, it's not a crazy view. But I think if you look at the texture of religion, if you look at what religions actually do and how they work, they seem to do a lot more about, well, basically helping their members and binding them together and helping them do things that they couldn't do as individuals. I'll just read a quote for you. I happen to have a quote here, but I quote in the book by Robert Putnam, one of the political scientists who studied social capital and trust. And he has a book out called American Grace where he reviews all the evidence on religion in America and what are religious people really – are they crazy, ignorant, selfish, violent, racist? I mean, no. When he looks at all the data, he concludes – let's see. By many different measures, religiously observant Americans are better neighbors and better citizens than secular Americans. They are more generous with their time and money, especially in helping the needy, and they are more active in community life. So, you know, even though I was very hostile to religion when I was a teenager and in my 20s, I've got to be open to the evidence here. I think religion in America, at least, is quite a benevolent force. And there are some other countries where it's not. But at least in the American context where religions have to compete for members, they end up being pretty nice.
This goes to this idea of morality binding and blinding, because you say a lot of atheists, certainly some of what you call the new atheists, are treating science as something sacred, and they sort of fall into the same kind of thinking patterns, you say, that some religious people do.
Yep, exactly. Morality binds and blinds. If you treat something as sacred, you'll circle around it, and then you'll lose the ability to think critically about it. So the new atheists, as I see it, sacralize science itself, or reasoning. And you separate good versus evil. So science and reasoning is good. Religion and superstition is bad. And then you lose the ability to think critically. You lose any nuance in your thinking about science, which I think is I'm a scientist. I love science, but sometimes there are flaws in the process. I'm an atheist. I don't particularly love religions, but boy, they do some very good things. You know, the world is complicated. There are nuances. Nothing is all good or all bad, or not nothing. Most things are not all good or all bad. But once you join a team that circles around a sacred object, you give up your ability to see those nuances. And I think that's happened to some of the new atheists. I mean, you read them. They're angry. They're contemptuous. And their arguments are all on one side. They don't say, on the one hand, there's this evidence. On the other hand, there's that.
I wonder how people are reacting, because what you're doing in the book is you're saying we have these deeply embedded inclinations to put aside something that doesn't conform to our idea. Mm-hmm. And you're saying something that doesn't conform to a lot of people's ideas. I mean, how are people reacting to the message in the book?
So far, really well. So the way it's broken down is this. The book's gotten really, really good reviews from people on the center left and center right and from people who are religious but in a progressive way. people on the far right don't read it. People in really conservative religious groups don't read it. They tend not to read science trade books. Where it's gotten bad reviews is some on the far left. Yeah. Because on the far left, they're committed to saying our side is all right, the other side is all wrong. And I'm saying, well, actually, the two sides are like yin and yang. The two sides are experts in different virtues. We need both sides. And that's not a popular message on the far left. It hasn't gotten a good reception from some real – but I mean some – there has been some praise on the far left, but the bad reviews have come mostly from the far left. Mm.
Jonathan Haidt, his book is called The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. He joined us today from New York City. And Jonathan Haidt, thanks very much.
Oh, Doug, my pleasure. If people want to learn more, they can go to righteousmind.com.
We'll put a link to that, by the way, on our website. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to, we should say, to the California Guitar Trio, whose music has been our theme since we started this show in 2001. Our new theme music is composed by the local band The Moth and The Flame. We have assistance from Taylor Allman, technical direction from Mike Anderson. The show produced by Benjamin Bombard, Andy Lane Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.